Doug Segrist. There's always a Nashville connection, formerly with the Nashville Banner, former Tennessee and Alabama Sports Writer of the Year. He, of course, now in Birmingham. The TV show is called The Zone on ABC 3340. Doug, as always, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bill Park. Good to be here. Good to be back.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't realize this when I scheduled guests. The fact that going back to last hour, Joe Rexroad, who just a few days ago named this year's Tennessee Sports Writer of the Year. He had previously won the award when he was in Michigan. So the fact that our last guest, a multiple Sports Writer of the Year from different states, and now there's you, same situation. So I feel really blessed with all this knowledge joining my show today.
Well, I appreciate that, but that is the national broadcasters thing, and I only won that in the state of Alabama. The one in Tennessee was just the sweepstakes for best story from the Sports Writers Association. So they're really kind of two different awards. But, I mean, Joe's very deserving, and that is a huge, huge honor because it comes from your peers.
But here's the thing, though. If you're back in football before we got to the BCS and before we got to the college football playoff, if you were a national champion in the AP or the coaches poll, guess what? You were still national champs, correct?
Yeah, I would say mine's a little more valid than Alabama's 1941 national title.
Well, if you want to look, I look back, by the way, speaking of national championships, because everybody's always knocking Alabama as far as the numbers that they count on some of those obscure ones. And then I start going back and, you know, guess what? Every program in the country nationwide claims some of those obscure national titles. So don't be throwing rocks in glass houses. That's all I'll say about that, because
I totally agree. But I have a big problem with Alabama's 1941 national title. They played an incredible schedule, but they lost two games. They finished top 20. And the problem I have is that all the other ones have a legitimate claim. And it can't, you know, people make fun of it because in 1941, they should have removed it years ago.
Yeah, well, see, here's the thing. I have a problem with, in 66, the fact that Bama, back-to-back national titles, unbeaten in 66, so already the two-time national champs, and they go unbeaten in 66, and guess what? They finished third. So, you know, right. You can make arguments both one way, or the 77 team that went into the Sugar Bowl ranked third. Number one goes down. Number two goes down. Alabama beats Woody Hayes' Ohio State team 35-6. They finish a close second. So, you know, you can make arguments one way or the other.
Montana.
Yeah. So, you know, you could throw things out there. Or how about Alabama winning the national title in 78, going unbeaten in 79. They take care of business against Auburn, and they drop from number one and number two. Luckily, there was an upset. Don't have to worry about national championship because they took care of business against Arkansas. But there's always those folks out there, especially when you got into voting back in that era compared to where we are today, that, you know, that had their biases. And, I mean, that's why we're talking about Paul Hornung on a 2-8 team for Notre Dame getting named the Heisman Trophy winner, beating out Johnny Majors from Tennessee.
And Majors was far more deserving that year, even though Hornung was a great, great player, but he played on a dog of a team. You know, and that's why we can criticize BCS and now the playoff, but this is such a better system that we have now. Now, you can say, you know, it takes away something from the regular season. I think it actually adds to the regular season. And I think in 4 years, they've gotten it right.
Today we find out, and not really surprised, I think the surprise would have been if the person I'm talking about did not get into the Baseball Hall of Fame, Chipper Jones, best or the top vote getter. And, you know, we'll never have a unanimous person getting elected into the Baseball Hall of Fame, because that's just how some of these weirdos are that vote on this, great, great honor. But certainly well-deserving of Chipper Jones, high 90s as far as his percentage. He's joined by Vladimir Guerrero, Jim Tomei, Trevor Hoffman. And, of course, they'll be a part of the class, which includes Jack Morris and Alan Trammell, who were both voted in by the Veterans Committee back in December. Here's the thing. I am so glad that Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds still not sniffing, you know, the getting voted in. You know, you need 75%, right? Roger Clemens, 57.3. Barry Bonds, 56.4. I bring it up because it's not just the fact, you know, there's some that argue, well, look, Barry Bonds, you know, he was a Hall of Famer before we think he started using steroids. Here's the problem, though. Until, like, a Dell Murphy or other deserving folks get in, think about, like, a Dell Murphy who every year was getting more and more votes, more and more support until we started getting those video game numbers during the steroid era. So what happened was these folks just went to the wayside, and now they're at the mercy of this Veterans Committee. Until those folks get in that were hurt by the Barry Bondses of the world, Sammy Sosa, Roger Clemens, et cetera, then I don't want any of those folks getting voted in by the Baseball Writers Association.
Well, I disagree, and I am a big fan of Murph. I think Murph deserves to go in the Hall of Fame. He not only did he never use steroids, I don't think he ever drank soft drinks.
Oh, I think you're right.
Yeah. But that is a guy, when you look at the multiple, the two MVPs and switching from catcher to center field, on some, you know, some bad Braves teams, but some of their better teams under Torrey as well. You know, that's a guy who, in that era, his numbers compared to anybody with exception of a low batting average, but not a batting average that would disqualify. I mean, he deserves. Luke Whitaker should go in there with Trammell. Again, for his numbers, if you compare him to the Robinson Canoes and the Jose Altuves of today, they don't compare. But in a pitcher's era, he was one of the great second basemen of all time. That said, Barry Bonds was the best outfielder of his generation. He was a five-tool player. I hate the steroid issue, but there are also other players going in who were maybe suspected of steroids but never proven, and they've made it in. I think unless we go back and test the blood of every player in that era, I don't know if we can just disqualify these guys. I think the fact they've had to wait so long is punishment enough. But Bonds and Clemens, to me, are two all-timers.
See, I disagree, especially about Barry Bonds. You know why? Because I, growing up, you know, from the ages of 6 to 11, I was in Birmingham, and certainly following closely Hank Aaron and Willie Mays' pursuit of Babe Ruth. And especially after Hank Aaron passed Babe Ruth to become the all-time home run king, it came out all the things that Hank Aaron was having to live with. When the fact that he ended the 73 season one home run short after hitting three home runs in that final game of 73, the fact that most folks felt like he was going to get assassinated sometime during the offseason because they didn't want a black man taking the record away from a white guy. And that's what the era we were living in back then.
Hey, and don't forget this, as he hits the record home run and these guys run on the field, I think everybody in the stadium, everybody watching on TV, has his collective gasp.
Right.
Because you think, oh, my God, these guys mean him harm. I mean, that's how precarious the situation was and how tense it was. And that's, again, what makes him a Hall of Fame, not only player, but a person, what he went through. And again, the Larry Dobies, the Jackie Robinson, the Willie Mays and Aaron came a decade later. The path had been paved by Robinson and Dobie, but they still encountered racism in the minor leagues. They encountered it on road trips. They encountered it at home. And there's no comparison, you know, to what athletes today go through. Not that things are perfect, but good Lord. I mean, these men went out on the field not knowing if they'd survive the day at times.
But there's a major but here. Barry Bonds, if he had not cheated, he would not have passed Hank Aaron as to become the all-time home run king.
I totally agree.
And that totally is the problem. The fact that he robbed baseball, as far as numbers, used to mean something. 714, 56, et cetera. You know, you think about NFL, you know the all-time greats. You don't know anything about the numbers, per se, not unless you're the person that keeps up with the stats for the NFL. You don't know how many yards Emmitt Smith ended up with. You don't know how many touchdown passes the all-time passing leader ended up with. You don't know how many touchdowns Jerry Rice ended up with as far as the all-time receiving leader. But you knew numbers as far as baseball. And that steroid era, the Barry Bondses of the world ruined that. And they took that away from Hank Aaron to become the all-time home run king because he cheated. Period. And so not only are you hurting innocent folks like Hank Aaron, you're hurting the folks like the Dale Murphys who got no more support because of those inflated numbers during that era as far as the steroid era. So if Barry Bonds gets in and Roger Clemens, guess what? They can one day maybe get in as far as from the Veterans Committee. I do not ever want them voted in by the Baseball Writers Association.
Well, I think it will take another 10 years for them to get in with the Veterans Committee.
Well, that's the only way they'll be able to get in.
Roger Maris lived with the Astros for 30 years. He died with the Astros because he played four more games than Babe Ruth did during his record home run season. So baseball needs to at least acknowledge that some of these rules are under question. Some of these records are questionable.
Having a chance once again to visit with Doug Segrist out of Birmingham. The TV show is called The Zone on ABC 3340. Earlier in the show, we had Barton Simmons on, director of scouting with 247sports.com. And it's interesting to see where we stand with 2 weeks to go with this year's recruiting class. You know, there's Ohio State just this week jumped back over Georgia by just a minuscule of percentage points here. But to me, it's the race on who's going to catch Georgia as far as the East is concerned. And it's right now you've got three teams battling it out all in the top 20 with Florida, Tennessee, South Carolina, all in that order. I like seeing that because I want to see the East relevant again. I want to see the East to be closing the gap on the West. And to me, it just makes Saturdays a lot more interesting. Before we get to the point of competing for division titles, you have to win the recruiting wars. And right now, there's four teams that are showing that they're up for the task, especially in the East.
Well, I don't know. Did you mention Kentucky?
Well, Kentucky and Vanderbilt, they're all in the top 37, 38.
Right.
So you've got Kentucky and Vanderbilt right there, too, which speaks volumes. So,
and I think, again, it's a matter of upgrading the coaching staffs. Butch Jones could recruit, but now you've got a guy that we think can actually develop players and win long-term. I mean, the East is cycling back up again, and we may see – I don't know if we'll see a shift to the domination that the West had, but it may be at least the point where there's balance 1-4 on both sides.
Let's turn attention to college basketball in the SEC, because I remember having this conversation with you. It just seems like yesterday when – three teams, maybe four, will get in as far as their tickets punched as far as the big dance is concerned. The fact that right now every team except Vanderbilt, top 100 as far as the RPI, the fact that the SEC leads the country with eight teams in the top 40 as far as RPI as of this week. This league, especially depending on how things play out over the next 6 weeks, we could be talking about 9 or 10 teams enjoying, play as far as the NCAA tournament is concerned.
Yeah, I honestly think 8 is the minimum at this point just because the league is so balanced. And a lot of that depends. What does Texas A&M do the second half of the season? Because, they were a top 5 team going into play, and they're 2-6 now. We know they're good. Heck, Vanderbilt's 7-13. We know that Vanderbilt, on a good night, can play pretty much anybody in the country, especially at home, and they're already out of the picture. But that's it. Everybody else right now is viable. Ole Miss had a big win over Alabama last night that can help them climb back into consideration. I made the point on the TV show the other night that everyone in the SEC right now, even Florida, even Auburn, even Kentucky, should consider themselves on the bubble because anything can happen going down the stretch. I think if there's a lock, it may be Tennessee just because of that schedule and who they played the non-conference portion of the season. I think Saturday is huge with the Big 12 matchups. Even though it shouldn't factor in Selection Sunday, it's in the back of people's mind. Again, it's about perception. They don't pick conferences, they pick teams. But all of a sudden, if if you went 9-9 in one of the two best leagues in the country, it means a little more. And I think right now you can argue that the SEC is at least one of the three best conferences.
Doug Segrist joining us again. Help me understand the reason behind the direction as far as Auburn is concerned with the naming of their new AD. I was, you know, trying to figure out the connection. I'm trying to figure out, okay, there's Buffalo, and maybe he's good at fundraising.
Auburn is its endowment, its fundraising have kind of tapered off recently. They need new energy. This guy who did it at Ole Miss, but he's also kind of an out of the box pick. He's, you know, his first day on the job, he hits a home run in the press conference, and then he's at the basketball game, leading students in cheers. I mean, he's very personal, very charismatic. He only has 2 years as the AD at Buffalo in terms of experience, but he has worked under some really good people. I think the hope is this is a guy that can energize the fan base, can put some bad things that have gone on off the field as well as on the field behind and get the money pouring back in. You know, to me, whether he's a success or not depends on the good old boy network. You know, do they stay out of the way? Do they try to micromanage like they have in the past? If they let it do its job, I think he can be very successful if they want. If they won't, they're going to be looking for a new guy in 2 or 3 years.
Look, there's not an AD at a Power 5 conference. I don't care if you're the worst of the Power 5 conference teams that are not micromanaged by the boosters or other folks on that campus if you're an AD. So whether you're Allen Green at Auburn.
I agree that it's very common. But micromanaged to the point of where people, you know, telling you, you know, you've got to have a role in choosing the coaching staff and the coordinators, et cetera. That goes a little too far. And I remember having this conversation with Roy Kramer 15, 20 years ago, and that was the biggest problem in the SEC because at the smaller schools, you know, SEC teams tend to be the major league franchises for a lot of cities and a lot of states, and you can have 2 or 3 people who call all the shots because they offer so much, produce so much more money in terms of donations to the athletic department, and that's your fear. You have to answer these people. It's not right, but there have been some exceptions where people have said no, and the athletic departments have flourished. Now, I go back and look at what Mal Moore did in kind of keeping people off of Nick Saban. You know, and Granny had the one head coach that it would work with, but he kind of created a buffer where all of a sudden these boosters no longer had access to the football coach, and it worked. Will it work for the next guy? I don't know.
Yeah, you brought up Roy Kramer. It's intriguing to know that he is a neighbor of my in-laws, my wife's parents over in the Greenback area, Teleco Lake, if I recall. So it's intriguing you bring that up. Big challenge coming up on Saturday as far as the SEC taking on the Big 12 that only has 10 teams. So you do the math. I'm sure that confuses elementary kids when they look at the Big Ten, realize that there's not 10 teams in the Big Ten and there's not 12 teams in the Big 12, but I digress. But opportunities are there certainly for the SEC. You mentioned A&M. You know, they're on the road at fifth-ranked Kansas, Oklahoma ranked in the top 12. They're at Alabama, just to name a couple of those teams that are highly sought of. These are great opportunities, in fact, final opportunities for that part for the SEC to prove themselves outside the conference to get some major competition before the stretch run. As always, Doug, we appreciate you. Remind the listeners again how they can keep up with all your coverage.
On Twitter at DSegrist, in the Montgomery Advertiser during the football season, and our show, I hope, it's still going strong. It's called The Zone. We're on Sunday nights on ABC 3340 in Birmingham.
Doug, we appreciate you, buddy. Have a great rest of the week. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, Ballpark. Have a good one.
You too.